Hey everybody, welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer Francis Buckley. He's going to tell us some stories about working with the likes of Quincy Jones, Alanis Morissette, and even Black Flag. So that should be fun. But first, let's talk about the three elements of online promotion. Most artists and musicians have an online presence, but there's no strategy behind that presence, and they don't think of how all of the elements of their online presence fit together and in what categories they fit together. So if we really think about this hard, we find that there's three basic elements of online promotion. The first one is content. We all generate content, and that content could be music, it could be videos, it could be writing, it could be blog, lots of different things, but it's all of the things that we generate, all the content we generate. So think about it for a second. What are the things that we do online that fall into the content element? Well, there's your website. Your website is full of content. There's your mailing list. Your mailing list, of course, has to have some content or people aren't going to read it. There's your blog, if you have one. A blog is nothing but content. Your YouTube videos or any of your videos that are online. Your music files that might be on SoundCloud, they might be available on iTunes for download. Anything that you have that's your content, that's your creation, that all falls into the content category. The second one is interaction. And these are all of the social media elements where you interact with your fan base and they interact with you. So think about it. For instance, we have Facebook. We have Twitter, Google+, Instagram, Pinterest, all the bookmarking sites like Reddit, for instance, or Dig. Any kind of social network falls into the interaction category. And the third one is tactics, and this is one that everyone overlooks, tactics. So we have three parts of tactics. The first is branding. Of course, we're always branding ourselves, or we should be. We should be thinking about our personal brand or our band's brand. Branding is a part of life, and if you're smart, you're always trying to brand yourself or expand that brand. The second thing is strategy, and the strategy is, okay, what are we doing now? What are we doing going forward? And how are we going to be doing all this? So that's strategy. And the third part is measurement. One of the beautiful things about the internet is we can measure all the things that we never could before. We can measure all our interactions. We know how many likes we get. We know how many retweets we get, for instance. We know how many people have viewed our videos or have downloaded a song or have listened to a song on SoundCloud. We know all those. So we can even take that further. We can look at the demographic of who it is that's actually listening or watching our content or consuming our content. We can know all those things that we never could before. And if you're smart, you're putting that together with your strategy and your branding. And that comes under the category of tactics. So now we have content, and we have interaction, and we have tactics. And where these all cross is where we get promotion. You need to have all three to have an effective online strategy. And obviously, it's more than we can just talk about in a couple minutes. This is something that really takes a long time, and I give a full day's lecture of this when I'm asked to speak. But you can see it's a subject that we can break it down into just some very simple segments, very simple categories, and how they all fit together is our online strategy. Next thing I want to talk about is PV. Yes, the brand PV, and the company is restructuring. Now, first of all, PV is now in their 50th year. Yes, it's their 50th anniversary. This has been the backbone of the music business for a long time, one of them anyway. They were always an alternative to Fender or Yamaha. So in other words, if you're a music store and you couldn't get the Fender franchise, you couldn't get Yamaha, well, you'd go and you'd get PV. PV was always a good alternative, and PV was good for dealers. It was good for musicians. It was always inexpensive, well-made gear, and for the most part, it was always made in the United States. One of the problems that we're seeing here is even a company like PV that's long been known as standing up for the American worker, even they're moving to Asia. So there's a lot of manufacturing that's moving over there. One of the things they're doing now is they're downsizing. So they're laying off 100 people, which is kind of a drag. And this is right in their home base of Meridian, Mississippi. And they're also closing their UK distribution center. That being said, PV is strong. It's stronger than ever. And they're in a lot of different places. They still make guitars, amplifiers, everything else you can think of, but very, very strong in the sound reinforcement. And they're even very strong into venue sound now for like churches and any kind of venue. So that's PV. They're restructuring, but they are in their 50th year, and congratulations, PV. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. My guest today is Francis Buckley, and he's engineer for the likes of Quincy Jones, the Pointer Sisters, Alanis Morissette, even Adam Sandler, and also the one I want to talk about, the godfathers of punk, Black Flag. Francis has worked on 6 number one albums, 3 number one singles, and 15 top 10 singles, and he's won several Grammys, Emmys, and Golden Reel Awards. I spoke with Francis from his home via Skype. All right, Francis, thank you for being in my inner circle. I appreciate you taking the time to come on and have a chat.
My pleasure, Bobby. Thanks for having me.
Let's go back to the beginning. I know a lot about you, but I don't know how you started in the business.
I was a musician. You know, I spent my 4 years of high school in both band and choir, and joined my first band. I played drums, and actually, the guy who taught me to play drums, he was my grandfather's cousin. His name was Joe Bredo, and he and his wife played in the original NBC orchestra on radio, and he was one of these guys that just lived and breathed music. It was so great to be around him because he had like all this crazy old stuff, man. He had lots of old percussion instruments. He gave me a 26-inch Slingerland bass drum with calfskin heads on it, man. It's just wow. All this crazy old stuff. But he's the one who really lit my fire because he said to me, "I'll bet you everybody in the family is saying music's a wonderful hobby, but it's not a way to make a living." And I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what I hear." He said, "Well, let me tell you this. I've been in the music business my entire life. I never lived high on the hog, but I loved every minute of it." And boy, that just went right into my heart, man. And it was like, that was one of the things that I carried with me when I graduated high school and went to work in the auto plants in Detroit. It really occurred to me, I'm not really into cars. So what am I doing in the auto industry?
Well, right? Wait, so you're from Detroit?
Yeah.
Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Actually, from the city itself, my father was a fireman, and requirements were that you lived in the city. So, I like to explain to my students that I was raised in a very gang-infested neighborhood in Detroit. Of course, the gang was the mafia. So it was a whole different kind of infestation, but it was, you know, I mean, you would never know it driving up and down the streets, but you know, it was one of those neighborhoods.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so I always had California in the back of my mind. I'm not really sure why or where it came from. But the band that I played in, the six of us piled into a U-Haul van and a Pinto and came out to California in 1977. So been, you know, I guess one of these days I'll get my green card.
Yeah. You're a native now.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, but I was always interested in electronics, and I'm not an electrician. I'm terrible with a soldering iron. You know, it's like, you know, when I used to make model airplanes, there'd be glue all over everything. It's the same when I try to solder. But I was very interested in electronic music. I bought my first synthesizer in 1974, and I was very into it, but as a whole nother genre of music, not to replace a keyboard in a band or, you know, or whatnot. But when I was in college, I played in the jazz band. And I was one of like 27 drummers, and I wasn't that much of a jazz drummer. So I didn't get a lot of chance to sit behind a set. But I brought the synth in one day, and I said to the instructor said to me, "We're not making movie music here, you know." Yeah. And I said, "No." I said, "Whatever, what part can't you cover?" So I would be doing things like playing the third sax part or the fourth trumpet or something like that. And he was blown away with it.
Wow, you know? That's cool. What synth was it?
It was an electric comp. It was an EML-101.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
It was one of the first ones that was actually biphonic where you could play two notes at one time. It was the only synth in the world that did it.
Those are rare in the States.
Yeah, they really are. I mean, I found one at a little music store that the guy was really into synths. He had one of the ARP 2600, you know, the big one. Was all patching. And what I liked about the EML was the fact that it did have a full patch panel across the top.
Yeah.
So you could rearrange, which you couldn't do with a Moog or any of the other small ones, you know.
Yeah.
But that sparked my interest. So I bought myself a little Tascam 4-track and started doing electronic music as a John Cage, Karlheinz Stockhausen kind of compositions. You know, so that's kind of what led me into engineering. Was I was the band. My band did what all bands do, which is, of course, break up.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of like, okay, you know, what am I going to do now? And that whole, why am I in the auto industry if I'm not into cars, was playing in my head. And it's like, well, I'm into music, so I should be in the music business. And it wasn't a, I don't care what, you know what I mean? It wasn't one of those kind of drive, but it was like, you know, so I got offered a job of running live sound at University of Michigan, and I was going to move back when, but they said you need some kind of education. So I went to Dick Grove Music Workshop.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. They had a 10-week engineering course, and you know, a 10-week engineering course is like, there's a tape machine, there's a board. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And, but Dick Hunt, the guy who ran the place, came to me, you know, at the end of it, and he said, what are you going to do now? And I said, I'm not really sure. He said, well, you have a really good knack for this. You should continue your education. And he pointed me to Brian Inglesby's Soundmasters.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where I went to school with Soundmaster. And they're the ones who got me the two jobs that really kind of launched me. They sent me to Unicorn Records in Hollywood. And I was there about 3 weeks. I mean, the job was kind of, here's a set of keys. That was the job description. And I worked with John Guess, and I worked with Ed Stasium and a couple of other guys. But I was there a very short amount of time, like 3 weeks, maybe a month, when I came in one day and the chief engineer had quit and she made me chief engineer. So a little over a year out of school, I'm chief engineer. And, you know, she said, you're now chief engineer and Black Flag will be here at 1 o'clock to start their new record.
Oh, man.
So the album Damage was the first album I ever engineered. And it was, you know, the producer was a guy named Spot. And, you know, as I was taking the longest walk of my life, which was from her office to the studio.
Yeah.
I told myself, you know, first of all, you know, I can do this. I've been well trained. Brian Inglesby trained me very well. And I also said, I'm not going to let anybody else know it. You know what I mean? Never let it see a sweat. But when Spot got there, I told him, I said, look, you know, I've never worked this board. You know, I've assisted, but I haven't really put my hands on it. And he said, don't worry, man, we'll get through it. And so I was there about a year when school sent me over to Universal, to MCA Music Publishing. And I got the job there as chief engineer there, where I worked for 10 years with Glenn Ballard and, you know, and a lot of other, I mean, all the great songwriters were coming through there.
Sure.
And that was the time from 81 to 91 was when the transition from the traditional record producer to the actual songwriter being the producer. That's, and of course, I knew all the songwriters.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was kind of how I, you know, stepped into it.
Well, let's go back to Black Flag for a second, because yep. I know you work with Quincy, and you know Black mm-hmm. Flag to Quincy is a big difference there.
Yeah.
So, what was it like when you did more punk then, I assume, from there on?
I kind of did everything.
Yeah.
There wasn't, you know, and Unicorn Records just happened to have signed a deal with SST, which was Black Flag's label.
Yeah.
So we worked with the Meat Puppets, and we worked with. I want to say Husker Du, but it might not have been Husker Du. There were a bunch of those bands in that era that I worked with. But one of the things that it taught me, now I was not into punk at all. I mean, I was into progressive music. I was into that kind of music that you'd go to see the band play and you'd just drool watching these guys play.
Yeah.
You know, but one of the things I learned and one of the things I really stress and try to pass on to my students is that one of the hardest things you have to learn to do as an engineer is work on stuff that you're not particularly into.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not to say that the music isn't any good. It's just not your cup of tea.
Right.
But, you know, I always tell them the two most important words on any record are Francis Buckley.
Yeah.
You know? And to me, the greatest compliment is when somebody says, man, that album sucked, but it sure sounded good.
Yeah, right, right.
You know? So that's the thing. It's like your name is going on there. So you have to bring the full toolkit every time you come in. There's no phoning it in.
Were those records done quickly, the punk records? Because, I mean, everybody tells me that I never worked on any of those, but everyone says, yeah, you know, they came in and out just like the blues guys, you know?
Well, I guess fortunately for myself, not having had a ton of studio experience as to, you know, on making big records, we did three or four there with, like I said, I assisted for John Gass and I assisted for Ed. And things just, they seem to move along. The Black Flag album was kind of a blur because of the fact that, you know, I was in this situation where it was like, you know, the first time you're ever doing it. And this is kind of a, you know, you've been thrown into the deep end of the pool, you know.
Yeah.
So it seemed to move along. I don't remember it as having taken a very long time, but I certainly do remember it being very dramatic. I mean, the guys in Black Flag were total pros. And that's one of those things to me. It's like, you know, I can deal with a jerk who's a pro.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't deal with a really nice guy who's totally unprofessional.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that really taught me. I mean, Henry Rollins was like as into it as could possibly be. The whole band was very cool. They went in, they played their parts. Spot the producer was he had a set of ears that, you know, what's his name? Greg Ginn would hit one of his big power chords like and he'd go, I think your third string's out of tune. And he'd turn off the pedals, and sure enough, man, that third string would be out of tune.
Oh, very cool.
So, yeah, it was cool. Spot taught me, you know, taught me how to edit 2-inch tape, which first time I saw him do that was kind of like,
yeah, yeah, right.
What did you just do? You know?
Yeah.
So it was a great situation all the way around. And after all these years, that's the one album that I get people coming up to me and going, hey, man, did you, you know, young kids. Yeah. And it's like, wow, man, that blows my mind. You know,
you never know what is going to resonate with people. That's the funny thing. Well, how did you get to working with Quincy Jones?
Well, mostly it was through my association with MCA, Universal, and Glenn Ballard, because Glenn was signed as a producer to Quincy. And we did, I know this, it seemed like a strange artist to be signed under Quincy Jones, but we did the Jack Wagner All I Need project. And then we did, Glenn and I did a lot of R&B, man. We did Evelyn King and Thelma Houston. And I think we did four records with the Pointer Sisters with Richard Perry. And so we were doing a lot of that. And I did a couple of small things with Quincy. And then just by, I guess, a twist of fate, at the time he got ready to do Q's Juke Joint, Bruce Houdin was doing History with Michael Jackson, so Bruce was not available. So my friend Jolie Levine, who was the production coordinator and been Quincy's coordinator for years, you know, was one of those, she calls me up, she goes, would you be interested in doing this Quincy Jones record? You know, I was like, nah, sorry, man, I gotta, you know.
Yeah, right.
I got something else going on. But that was an amazing experience all the way around. Just being in the room with Quincy is in and of itself an experience. He's one of those guys that, you know, the old saying, the tide raises all ships.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, everybody gets elevated in that atmosphere because you're in the room with Quincy.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that I always liked about working with Quincy is he's the personification of this saying, you can tell a lot about a person by how he treats somebody, I don't want to say of no value, but he would come in the room and the first person he would talk to is the assistant engineers.
Yeah, yeah.
Last person he would talk to was usually the artist, you know, unless there was something specific that he needed. But he would come in and he was, you know, he was cordial to everybody. And if somebody had something to talk to him about, he would listen. And it was just that kind of I don't know, an overall sort of thing, his vibe, you know?
Yeah, I know. I did an interview with him, and it was a video interview. I don't remember what it was for, but mm-hmm. I remember it was at his house, and he treated everybody like he knew them. I mean, he just had this way of bringing you in like you felt like you've known him for a long time, and he felt he knew you for a long time.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. You know, he invited us to, during the making of the record, he invited my wife and I to a luncheon. He was getting some, my wife always remembers what it is. It was a humanitarian award, nothing big, but just, you know, a luncheon that he invited us to. So my wife and I go, and we're standing in the lobby of this restaurant, and I'm talking with Jerry Hay and a couple of other people. And I says to my wife, who's standing in front of me, I said, "Turn around very slowly." And she turns around very slowly, and standing behind her is Barbara Streisand and Oprah Winfrey.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And, you know, Gregory Peck was there and all these other people. And when Quincy gets up to start talking, he said, "It's so great to see so many old friends and some new friends." He goes, "It's really great to see Francis Buckley and his wife, Kim." And it was like,
that's awesome.
Yeah. You know, yeah. So, you know, and I don't really get the feeling that that was one of those things that he did where he's like, you know, "I'm going to make Francis feel special by pointing him out." No, it just, it was like, it was a genuine, a genuine gesture, you know.
What was he like in the studio? How was he different from other producers that you work with?
I'll tell you, the biggest thing is that he understands every aspect of making music, everything from the concept of the melody to the microphones that you use. Okay. Now, he never once said to me, "That's the wrong mic," or "This isn't the way to record it," or anything. He is, "You're a pro. You're here to do your gig. Do your gig, you know."
Yeah.
But you better be doing it right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In fact, when we did the Q's Juke Joint record, we did, I would say, 95% of it on the black-faced ADATs.
Really? Are you kidding me?
I wish I wasn't. No, at the time when we started the record, the idea was he wanted to make a live album. We were going to go to Capitol, and we were going to pull out tapes, and we were going to pull the voices off of tapes, recut the band behind it. Okay, so I come into Capitol, and there's all these strange tape machines, three track, and all this crazy stuff. Well, the first one he wanted to do was "Fly Me to the Moon" with Sinatra. So they put up the original three track, and we play it, and, you know, it's two tracks of the band and one track of Sinatra. Problem is, Sinatra's in the room with the band.
Oh, yeah.
So we couldn't do anything about it. So it was kind of the whole concept of the album sort of changed in that one day from being a live album to just being a regular studio album. And when I originally started, it was 4 days. That was what I was going to be there for, because I was going to cut the band. Al Schmidt was going to come in and do the big band horns. Mick Kozowski was going to set up the mixes, and the artists were going to come in and sing to the mix as it went down. That was the plan.
Wow.
Yeah, so at the end of 4 days, we don't have a whole lot done. So I said to Jolie, I said, "What, you know, now what?" And she said, "Well, you know, we'll just kind of wait and see." So I told her, I said, "I'll clear my calendar, and if Quincy needs me next week, I'm available." Well, that went on for 7.5 months.
Not a bad gig.
It was awesome. I never knew what to expect. You know, I never knew what was coming in. You know, it was kind of like, well, we might have this person, that person. But my favorite one was, we cut "Let the Good Times Roll," which is a song with three verses, right?
Yeah.
So he said, "We'll absolutely get Ray Charles for the last verse," you know? So, I mean, I was over the moon about that. Ray, I saw, you know,
yeah.
First time I saw Ray was 1972 at the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival. And it was like, this was, you know, it was absolutely amazing. So the day comes for we're going to cut the vocals. Well, who does Quincy show up with but Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, and Bono?
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, and that was the tone of the album. It was, I never knew, you know. But the most fun was when we were finished every night, he would send somebody out for a relatively expensive bottle of wine. And we would sit in the studio and just, he would tell stories. Or whoever he had there. He had, it was in one evening we were there with him and Nancy Wilson. And they were talking about touring back in the day. And it was like, God, I hope this night never ends.
Yeah. If only had a tape recorder running at the time, you know.
Yeah. You know, but that was like the end of the day. And it was like, oh, okay, we're going to sit back and have a glass of wine. It's like, last thing I'm thinking about is putting something in to record.
Yeah, right. You worked on Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill as well, right? Because of Glenn, your relationship with Glenn.
Yeah. That was another one of those interesting stories. What I love about Jagged Little Pill was it was kind of like the the what was best about the business and what was bad about the business, all in that one record, you know, in the fact that, like, she had been somewhat of a pop star in Canada. She was kind of they had the moniker, which I always loved, the Paula Abdul of Canada.
Oh, boy. That's not exactly one you want.
No, but, and I guess from what I understand, it was a prefab sort of thing. And they had it all. They had the songs. They had the whole thing. They were just looking for somebody to be the central figure. And she would, you know, they found her. Well, she came down to L.A. to write, and she was signed with MCA in Canada. So they sent her around town, and nothing was working. And they finally called Glenn and said, would you work with this girl? And he said, yeah. So she came over. And I might be mistaken, but I think they did either Ironic or You Ought to Know that first day.
Wow.
It's the very first thing they wrote. So we did a lot of demos, as we always did at MCA. There would be, you know, MCA was one of the first publishing companies with its own recording facility.
Yeah.
And I'm forever in the debt of Leeds Levy, who was the president at the time, because he said to me, we don't do demos here. We do unfinished masters.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, man. He was very serious about doing it. And there were a lot of Pointer Sisters records where the basic track were the demo tracks that we cut. And Richard would just buy the tape, and that would become the record, you know. So at MCA was, you know, everybody wandered through there. And so we were just down there cutting these demos. It was no big deal. You know, the whole record was just that kind of, I want to say, the kind of record I never thought Glenn would ever make, because he was very precise, very precision. There were no accidents on Glenn Ballard Productions. You know, the Wilson Phillips records were, you know, huge, glossy pop records. It just were, you know, his own signature. But with this, it was just kind of like they were songwriting demos. And there were a few overdubs that were on it. And there was a magic and an urgency. In fact, Perfect, which is one of the songs that I mixed on there, they wrote that in a day. And Glenn called me about midnight to come down and mix it. And they sent it to the record company, and they got a couple of the other big time mixers to do it, and couldn't get what was there on the original. So that's what they went with. And I really, there's a lot of in the record company that I give it up to them for, you know, not shining that record up, you know.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, it got every nod it could from Neris, except engineering, which I totally agree with. You know, I mean, it got record of the year, album of the year, but not best engineering, because it really, you know, it is what it is.
But no one was concentrating on that, though. It sounds like.
No, and I think that's the beauty of it, is that we were just writing songs and seeing what we could come up with, it was a fascinating project, because when Glenn took it out to shop it, as with, you know, the Beatles, she got turned down by everybody.
Yeah.
You know? In fact, I remember when after that record, we were doing the Aerosmith record. And, you know, Steven Tyler said he wanted to write a book called All the People That Turned Down Alanis Morissette. You know,
I'm just reading his book right now, actually.
Yeah.
That came out, which is a hoot, I got to say.
Yeah. Fascinating bunch of guys. But when everybody turned it down, and finally Madonna, who I guess was under some sort of a contractual thing that she had to put an album out that year, just said okay and signed her and just put it out. And it wasn't like, you know, there was no billboards on Sunset Boulevard for Alanis Morissette. There was no full page ad anywhere. It just, they released it to college radio, and it did what every great record has ever done. It just caught fire.
Yeah.
But it was a place in time, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Let's come back to, you did a lot of glossy productions.
Mm-hmm.
What makes a glossy production? When you're mixing, what were you doing?
Well, my whole thing, I'll tell you who was my big inspiration, and a lot of it I didn't even realize who he was or that I was being inspired by him, is your good friend Ken Scott.
Ah, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I hold his records up as to me, it's like, man, there isn't anything in there that you can't hear. There isn't anything in there that isn't a compliment to something else. So to me, it was like, it wasn't like today's productions where you can take all the time you want and you can try a million different things and whatnot. It was of when we recorded something, is this fitting in with what we already have, that we have already decided that this is a master? You know, we're not going to go back and recut the drums. We're not going to go back. I mean, we cut, to me, a great record is the band and the studio playing together. That's a great record. And most of the productions up until, you know, I think Quincy was the first record I actually ever used a Pro Tools system on.
That, right? Really? That long ago? Wow.
Yeah, 95.
Wow.
It just changed from Sound Tools to Pro Tools.
Yeah.
And it was very, it was still very problematic. But we used it to build at the beginning, there's a big collage of voices. And that was all done with Pro Tools. But it was a matter of, is what I'm recording fitting in with what I have already recorded? Mm-hmm. You know? I don't know that I have, at least in my own mind, I don't have a particular engineering style. For me, it's everything is a fresh start. You know?
Yeah.
I don't write down settings. I write them down, of course, for recall. But I never go back and go, what did I do to get that sound? I go, well, I know I used this, that, and the other thing. Because I loathe cookie cutter. I don't walk in and go, okay, give me my usual mic and my usual preamp and my usual this and that. It's like, you know, I was taught to record with bare minimum, you know. Back in those days, we were inventing things.
Yeah, sure.
You know, triggering drums and stacking vocals, and you know the way with Quincy, the way we used to get those huge vocal stacks was to, he would have four singers come in and they would all sing the first note of the chord, and then they'd double it and triple it, and then all of them would sing the next note of the chord and double it and triple it. So you'd have this big huge thing, which we then of course would mix down to stereo.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a decision made. So I think a lot of it had to do with the format that we were working with, where we were forced to make decisions, that we were forced to get stuff to work together because there was no going back.
Yeah, not a bad thing, actually. Yeah. I learned on 8-track, and I thought that was a wonderful format because you had just enough to play with, but yet not too much that you didn't, you had to make decisions. It was great.
You know, one of the great lines from a Billy Joel song is that he says, all your choices make you change your mind.
You know? Yeah, it's great.
And it's like, if you got 127 tracks, you know, it's there was one of this young kid named Mike Wade that I'm mentoring. He put on Facebook the other day, how many tracks should there be in a production? And all of these comments came in. And my comment was, it's not the tracks in your production. It's the production in your tracks.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really, to me, it's like, what I see today is no one sees the end. They see the process, and that's cool. The process is, you know, the journey is half of the trip, but it's more about what it is we're doing at the moment than what it is that we are trying to do as an overall sort of concept, you know. But I never set out to make glossy records. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm just very careful. And of course, you know, that was the days of analog tape. And so we had to be sure that, you know, nothing was making any noise and, you know, all that stuff that we had to deal with back in those days, which you don't really have to deal with that much nowadays.
Well, were you using a lot of effects?
Reverbs and delays.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course the usual compression and limiting. But I think one of the things that was cool about, you know, when you and I were coming up was that we didn't have unlimited number of 1176s. We didn't have 75 Pultecs. We had a couple of them, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm working with now is I don't know, you want me to mention products or?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, okay. I started working with this thing called Console One from SoftTube.
Yeah. Right.
And one of the things that I noticed was mixes were coming up a lot faster. They were sounding deeper and clearer and with more imaging in them. And I started thinking about, you know, is it SoftTube's plugins? What is it that's sounding better? And the more I thought about it, I went, you know, back in the day, we had a single unifying factor to all of the audio, which was the console.
Yeah.
Everything went through that console. So it all got treated with the same electronics, right? And they were generally really high quality electronics. That's why when people say to me, you know, why did the old records sound better? It's because they had better electronics, man. We're running through, you know, $100 microphone into a $75 mic pre.
Yeah, right.
Plugged into a $250 interface. It's like, come on, you know. So it was much more of a challenge in making records because there wasn't much to hide behind. You know?
Yeah.
So anyways, with this console, what I started thinking was, yeah, that's true. Back in the day, I would use pretty much one type of EQ, which was the EQ that was on the board. And you'd bring in a few esoteric pieces for the lead vocal or, you know, a nice EQ or something like that. Well, nowadays, we got all these different manufacturers with all these different types of plugins. And you may be using, you know, 10 EQs, but they're all EQs from different manufacturers who have different phasing and timing and all kinds of different issues, you know.
Yeah.
And then there's no console. So there's no this one single unifying factor. So to me, when I was working with Console One, because that's what it would be, I would just load up the entire mix with all the same EQ. And if I wasn't getting what I wanted, then I would put up something different. But I found that I was using probably almost as much as 80% fewer plugins because I was using one particular one across all of them, which was giving it a unified sound.
That's interesting. I never heard anyone delineate it like that, but you're absolutely right. Well, you know, when yeah. you think about it, you think, yeah, that was the one thing that everything went through the console, and yeah. and now it doesn't. It goes yeah. through, you know, whatever plugins you have or decide to use at that particular yeah. point.
And, you know, there wasn't a there were expensive recording studios and there were inexpensive recording studios, but they were all using the same caliber of electronics. You know what I mean? Yeah. You couldn't buy a cheap recording console.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, I mean, I was raised on the MCIs.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah. We had a 400 and a 500, and I think the first one I ever saw was probably at Total Access.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah, because the first studio I started working in was a little one that was about four doors down from Total Access. It was called WE Studios, and this would have been 79, something like that. So congrats to Wim Davis for having that studio where it is, still open all these years, man.
I just used it a couple of years ago, actually, on a project that was great. And actually, it was with Ken. Ken Scott came in and engineered basics for me.
Well, you know, in the in reading Ken's book and his interviews and whatnot, I was a huge David Bowie fan. I mean, I didn't know who he was. He came to Detroit in 1972 with Ziggy Stardust.
Yeah.
Right. So I saw the Ziggy Stardust tour. A friend of mine who lived next door came over and said, "Hey, man, I got a ticket to this show, but I got no way to get there. If you drive, I'll give you a ticket." So I went and it was like it was immediate. It was like, wow, for just the walk from the car to the concert hall. I'd never seen the glam rock before, man. A guy dressed all silver, painted silver face. It was like, this is going to be something different. And so I went and got a few of the records and it was like, there was something about those records. I could never put my finger on it, but there was something about those records that besides the unbelievable songwriting, just the whole thing of his whole – this wasn't the Beatles anymore, man. Yeah, this was like a whole different thing. And then when Ken was explaining how most of those vocals were in one take
– amazing.
That's what it is. Those are performances, man.
And the basics were no more than three takes.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there you go. Well, yeah. Speaking of Ken, mm-hmm. Ken tells a story in the book about working at Richard Perry about right. having the tremendous memory for different takes and different parts of different takes. Did you find that as well with Richard?
I think with Richard, because he had at his disposal whatever he wanted, he was able to do lots and lots and lots of different takes. And yeah, he had a pretty good memory for that stuff. An unbelievable producer, one of those guys who just knew how to get what he wanted. Sometimes it was a stroll around the block to get to the house next door, but you know he knew where he was going.
Yeah.
And it was always a lot of people in the room, a lot of stuff going on, and he could go, yeah, take 7 was the one that I want, or, you know, but he wasn't like, he wasn't quite like a, what's his name? Phil Spector, where he'd do 200 takes of the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, you know, some of the other guys who just, you know, eat through tape just because they're not sure what they got.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's one of the things that I really dislike about Pro Tools is that it allows you to keep everything.
And people do.
And they do. And it's, you know, and that's part of it. I mean, I, without knowing that I was following in Ken Scott's footsteps, I would, to me, it was like, I'll send a vocalist out and I'll give you 3 full shots. Sing the song top to bottom in 3 full shots. Because I'll tell you what, if you can't sing it in 3 takes, you're not going to sing it in 300 takes.
Yeah, right.
You're just not going to. You know, if a vocalist says to me, oh, I want to sing all the verses first and then I want to sing all the choruses, it's like, well, then you got the wrong engineer, man. Because that's, you know, then you get these stitched together performances.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and that's what, when I listen to all that early Bowie stuff, man, it's just, it's like there's an immediacy to it that just, and that I came to the, you know, discovery through Ken that that's how he did it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? Definitely.
You know?
You were mixing American Idol for a while. Are you still doing that?
What I was doing is I was doing the Ford music videos.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which was that, you know, that I guess that came out of a controversy between Ford and Coke that the judges are all sitting on television with a cup in front of them that says Coca-Cola, but there's no Ford vehicle around there. So Ford, so they gave them this 45 seconds to do a commercial. Well, Ford said, we don't want a commercial. We want a music video. And, of course, that was all done with Scott and Roger Wojahn from the Wojahn Brothers, which are...
There we go. Yeah. On your T-shirt.
So we were doing those, and those were a barrel of fun because it was always with the 12. In other words, those campaigns started on when they went to the final 12. Okay. So we were always working with the winners, and it was, I came in season 3, which was Carrie Underwood.
Oh yeah. Good time to be there.
Yeah. So I got pictures of my kids with Carrie Underwood before she was a star.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that went for, I want to say 8 or 9 years, and then they did away with the Ford music video. I don't know that I really, for myself, would have been interested in being the on-air mixer. You know, that early on when I started at Universal, I used to wander over onto the soundstage and watch him work. And it was like, after a couple of times of watching that kind of recording, it was like, you know, I wasn't really that interested because that's not really... You're not really part of a team like you are in a record.
Yeah.
You know, the engineer is so crucial to the making of a record, but crucial to making of a film, but not, it's kind of like, you know, 5 million people go by in the credit and it's like, oh, there I go.
You know? Yeah, right. Right.
You know, so film and television as being the, like, I don't really like being on a movie set. They're kind of fun until you've been there for 12 hours and nothing's happened. And,
yeah. Yeah. Right.
I did a TV show with Howie Mandel called Mobbed, and it was the usual thing. It was a flash mob with a budget is basically what it was. So all day long, it was rehearsals and setups and retakes and do this other stuff. And the actual surprise, which was a total surprise, happened at the end of the day. So that kind of made – normally at the end of the day, you're like, get me out of here. Yeah. This was like, wow, this whole thing, now it's going to happen and it's going to be live and it's either – you know, so – But just, you know, being on a film set or being in the whole making of film and television was not that interesting to me, you know, because I was into music.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Music.
You work with a lot of manufacturers.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, that all came about through Elisa's. And my very good friend Ted Kefalo, who is now the head of Equator, he was the number 2 man. He was head of marketing and whatnot, and he brought me in as a beta tester. And I really enjoyed that because that gave me the I'm one step ahead of a lot of people out there because, you know, not only do I know what's coming, but I know what's coming before you know it's coming because I'm looking at circuit boards and wires.
Yeah.
And mechanical drawings and them going, you think this would be viable as a product? So it kind of gave me this sort of edge, you know. And when the ADATs came along, it was one of those situations where I always had a different view of digital audio. I never loved analog or hated it, or loved digital or hated digital. I just saw those as storage mediums, and they're only going to store what I put on them.
Yeah. So I was never in love either way. I mean, it is what it is. Just a tool. Yeah.
I mean, analog, I guess the only thing I miss about analog tape is the smell of a brand new reel. Yeah. Other than that, you know, but when the ADATs came along, I embraced them heavily because I was, you know, I was part of the design and development team, and it was so much fun to go, wow, this is, and record something and have it come back exactly the way I put it down there.
Yeah.
Because they had, when the ADATs came along, the A to D converters that they were using, the work of people like Marcus Ryle and all those cats, it was like, you know, this was real scientists who were in love with the product that their products were going to be used in. In other words, these guys were all musicians first,
right?
You know, so Elise's kind of exploded, you know, they got really huge and just sort of collapsed under their own weight. And all the people that I knew from Elise's wound up at other companies.
Yeah.
So I would go to the NAMM, and where, you know, originally NAMM would take me a day, you know, now it takes me 4 days because I know so many people at so many places and started getting involved with all these different manufacturers, which is really fun. I really enjoy that.
I think that's where we met at Elise's, because
I think so.
I was on the beta team on a lot of projects. And mm-hmm. I also wrote a lot of their early marketing, a lot of ads and things, and manuals. I wrote a lot of their early manuals, too.
So did you work closely with Ted and Alan Wald? And
well, Alan mostly at that point, yeah. But of course, I knew Ted really well and still do. And I love his speakers. I use Equators all the time. So,
And he's one of the true unique characters of the manufacturing business.
He truly is.
There's nobody who says, I think I know Ted. No, you either know him or you don't know him. You know? He's his own man. You know? But, you know, it was a fun thing to do because I was always bringing new stuff into the studio, always something new. And the ADATs, we did so much A-B comparison. You know, I put it up against the big Sony 48. And, you know, I mean, the difference was so minor, and it wasn't one sounding better. It was just one sounding different.
Yeah.
You know, and I made the decision to use it on the Quincy record, but I called Elise's up and I said, look, I'm going to help put you guys on the map. And I want a tech here with me the whole time. So I think I had like 10 or 12 ADATs on hand, for which I was using between 4 and 6 the whole time. And I got to say, Liz, when we first started talking, you asked me about Quincy. He knows the process so well that he got hip to the fact that I could always give him 8 more tracks.
Yeah, right.
It was like, give me another track, you know. So I think when we finished that record, I think I had 1,000 ADAT tapes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, I had slaves and work tapes and copies, and you know, things were going off to Europe to have somebody put something on, and stuff was coming back, and you know, we did some of the early EdNet sessions on that. I recorded Phil Collins from Sweden and Shaka from London and Barry White from Boston and Gloria Stefan from Florida. So we did a lot of that sort of stuff as well.
It must have been crazy to keep track of everything.
Well, my assistant, Stephanie Gilden, and I came up with the librarying system, you know, so we had, you know, we came up with a system, but when we were done and it came time to mix, Quincy always had a notepad that had all of his, you know, calls and whatnot on there. And I was doing something, and I happened to look down at the paper, and there was a message on there from Bruce Swedeen just checking in, you know.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, man, you know, am I going to lose the mix on this thing? But when it came around to it, Quincy came to me and said, you know, he's going to have Bruce mix the record. And I said, well, Quincy, you've just made me the most nervous man in Hollywood.
Yeah. All right.
But it was a blessing in disguise because I realized that I had been working on all of that stuff for so long. And that was, you know, before the days of heavy duty recall and all that. So every day I had to come in and get up a rough mix. I had to bring up the faders and, you know, and every time we changed songs, it was like, pull the faders down, put the thing up, bring up another rough mix. So I had done mixes on all those songs over and over again. And I wasn't sure what I was going to bring to it.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so having a fresh set of ears, and of course, arguably some of the best ears in audio come in. But he gave me the greatest compliment I ever got in my career, which was he said to me, that was the easiest record I ever mixed because everything was where it was supposed to be.
Oh, wow. That is great. Any compliment from Bruce is major.
And of course, part of the reason it was like that is because when in the end, we transferred everything over to the 48.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't want Bruce swimming in a sea of tape.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I didn't want him because it can get with that many tapes and all that taking it in and out, you know, the cartridges and whatnot, got a little bit frustrating.
Yeah.
And I didn't want Bruce to run into that. I wanted him to have a, you know, smooth sailing thing.
Well, not only that, you're sure which takes are which takes and which tapes are which tapes. And so, it makes a lot of sense.
Because I didn't want to be off on some other project and have somebody call me and go, where the hell is this or where the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But of course, back in those days, that transferring digitally from ADAT to 3348 and all the synchronization and word clock and all that stuff was just starting to come in, and we were just beginning to understand what word clock meant and what synchronization, you know, the difference between analog and digital synchronization is, you know, is worlds apart, because with analog, there's a little amount of slop that you can't have with digital. So most of those tracks were transferred two tracks at a time.
That must have took a week right there.
Yeah, and I think I had three studios going, because I was still in the studio with Rod. We were still overdubbing right up to the very end.
Jeez.
You know.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What are you doing now?
Well, right now, I guess for lack of a better term, I'm sort of retired because of my hearing. Okay. You know, I always knew I had, first of all, I know that I hear differently in each ear. I think everybody does. And I can remember when I was a kid, my parents had a whole house fan that they would run in the summertime. And I could sleep on one side and it would sound one way, and I could turn my head the other way and it would sound different.
Yeah.
So I got some tinnitus in my one ear, which is, it's there. It's not, I'm not going to jump out a window. You know, it's not to that point yet. But I went to the audiologist with great trepidation. You know, it was like kind of like going to the oncologist when you already know the answer.
Yeah.
And the curve was not very good. At about 4K, it starts to slide. I noticed in school we would do ear training with frequencies. After we passed about 8K, it got quieter and quieter. There was one morning when I had it on 15K and I didn't realize the oscillator was on until I turned around and the students were all going, So I kind of decided that, you know, maybe for the longevity of my hearing, that maybe it was time to get out from in front of the speakers. You know, so it was a kind of an agonizing decision, because it really meant that what I've been doing for the last 30 some years is now sort of come to an end. But how do I put this delicately? It's kind of, somebody asked me, are you going to miss it? And I said, I already do, because it's not like it used to be, man. It's not, you know, the kind of sessions like Quincy where, you know, my new joke is there was a time when I was the least talented guy in the room.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
My career was blessed with working with guys like J.R. and Steubenhaus and Vinny and Landau and, you know, all these incredible musicians who could come in and in a take or two, you know, not only find the song, find the part, but get it recorded. And it was like, there were so many times I'm in the studio going, I can't believe that I'm in the room with these guys. How the hell did I get here? You know? And now, of course, I have to be the drummer. I got to be the guitar player. I got to be the singer. I got to know how to put somebody in tune. I got to be able to fix timing. And it's like, you know, if it was an incredible song that I was working on, I could bring something to it. But it just got to the point where it's like, you know, the songwriting, because again, my early years were with all the best songwriters in LA, man. And I knew a great song when I heard one.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, that's kind of one of my new things now is sort of advocacy for hearing protection, because, you know, we got artificial hearts and lungs and kidneys and all this other stuff, but we don't have artificial ears.
Well, isn't that why Quincy stopped producing as well? Because I remember when I interviewed him, he was telling me that he just came back from somewhere in Switzerland, where he got brand new hearing aids, and he said, "Well, you know, I can almost go back in the studio with these."
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think he's kind of saying the same thing that I said, because they, you know, and I'm sure that whatever hearing aid he was getting back then is leaps and bounds to what we have now.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
They're pretty spectacular, and what they'll do is they'll take your hearing back to what it was or what it theoretically should be, right? Yeah. The problem is you put these little amplifiers in your ear, and then what, you're going to go back into the studio?
Yeah, right.
Does
right.
that make a lot of sense? Not to me, you know. I mean, I love what I do. I've always defined myself by what it is that I do, but I think in the end it came down to that I just want to be in the music business, and I still am. You know, I'm working with all these manufacturers. In fact, when you and I are done today, I'm going to go to see Meyer Applebaum at his studio and take him some of these SBS design stuff that I've got for him to hear.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, still going around and being part of it and all that. But, you know, I don't know that, you know, the rugged life of a recording engineer is something that I would want to say, okay, I'm back into, you know, 18-hour days and, you know, just again, it all comes back down to that. It's not what it used to be.
I cannot work those days anymore.
No.
I can't. And I find, well, like for instance, I have a session tonight at 5 o'clock, and what's going to happen is I'm going to work all day. I start at 7 o'clock. It's like a second job.
Yeah.
You know, and as fun as it is, it's like, oh boy, by 10 o'clock, I'm beat. And you know, that, we would have just got started in some cases, you know, way back when. So it's all changed. And also just the fact that you're not around as many people. You're not in studios or facilities where there's other studios, you know, sit around and talk with people during a break. And you know, of course, it's all changed.
Well, you know, I always said if I was forced to make a decision as to what it is that I did, you know, in other words, somebody came to me and said, of all the aspects of making a record, you can only participate in one aspect. What would it be? It would be tracking.
Yeah,
get
right.
A studio with a bunch of crazy musicians and let's have some fun. Let's make music, even if it's difficult, even if it's really, really, you know, something that takes a lot of time. But at the end, you go, wow, man, that was cool.
Yeah.
You know? Mixing was always, you know, because I started when I started, an engineer was on the record from start to finish.
Right.
There was no bring in the superstar mixer. And then suddenly these superstar mixers came along. And I always thought, you know, I called it the lonely life of the superstar mixer, because you're in the studio all by yourself, or you're in the studio with everybody that's got an opinion.
Which is even worse, yeah.
Which is even worse, you know, because when you're tracking, everybody goes, wow, that's great. We're not done yet, so you know, we can come back in tomorrow and fix it. But the mix is always, you know, everybody that, you know, and the thing that always would drive me crazy was you would send somebody a copy early on and they would say, oh, no, it's too early for me to listen to. And then in the mix, they'd be going, you know, I don't think the drum part is right.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So, you know, but that's something that's always been there. Always been in the business, you know. My one of my records that I did for Clive Davis, he called me up to tell me about the mix, and you know, he said he really liked it. It just needed a new drum set, you know. And it's like, so let's not talk about the vocal level, then, shall we?
Yeah, right. I have a couple of questions for you. Final questions. The first is, I was looking at your website and I saw something there for designing your home studio.
Yeah.
What is that exactly? I tried to follow the link and it didn't really take me anywhere.
Well, because it's kind of, I've kind of pulled it because it was a video that I made a couple of years back, and I made an original one and I sent it to George Peterson, and George said, man, the content is great, but the delivery, it's so boring. And he was the guy that turned me on to the word infotainment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I went out and hired an actual director, and he said to me, well, if we're going to have entertainment, I'm going to get you a Tool Time girl. Okay. So the very, very attractive young lady in the video with me. And there was a company out of New York that was distributing it, and they said, you know, they're getting calls about they love the video, but the girl is a distraction, which, you know, I had one friend of mine say, I watched that scene three times and never got anything that you said. You know? But Designing Your Home Studio came out of, you know, having been one of the pioneers of this, you know, the small digital recorders and all that stuff. I found myself in a lot of people's home studios. I was the guy that was there during the transition from, you know, big studio to home studio. And of course, you'd walk into somebody's room and it was always like, okay, look, before we start, the speakers are wrong, the placement is wrong, it's all out of balance. And it just kind of grew out of that, that I was going around to people's studios and the first thing I would help them do is set up the studio. So I'm in the process of re-editing. I think actually what I'm going to do is kind of a recording YouTube channel and kind of do tips and tricks and hear him doing this and doing that and how to pull this off. And, you know, and that'll be a big part of it. You know, I also did Studio Rescue with Rode Microphone, which is another company I've been involved with for quite some time. And Studio Rescue is, in a weird way, is kind of like the Black Flag album. I can't go to a trade show now without somebody coming up to me and going, oh, man, you're that guy from that TV show. You know, so I said, next is Paparazzi and Bodyguards. You know,
okay,
it's a lot of fun. It was, you know, because, you know, everybody wants to have their studio set up properly. And, you know, the biggest thing that I find is that most people just do too much.
Right.
You know, they think they got to have every wall covered and no reflections. And, you know, so it's just a little bit of education just to kind of get you to the right spot. In fact, I've got one guy now who called me up about, man, I really need you to help me with my room. I said, well, what's wrong with your room? And he said, well, you know, I know it's not set up properly, but I really like the sound of what's coming out of there. I said, well, then don't touch it, man. You know, I love it. Let's change it. You know, yeah.
Last question for you.
Yeah.
What's the best piece of business advice that you ever received from someone or that you learned on your own?
Well, I don't know that this came from any one particular source, but it came from as many sources, including my mother when I was getting ready to go to school, which she said to me, take some courses in business. And I thought, I'm not business, I'm in music, and I don't need to learn the business. Learn the business. I mean, it really, you can't just assume that your record is going to take off. And I know this from reading all of your blogs. To me, like I always tell young artists, okay, we're getting ready to do our record. Okay, before you do your record, what are you going to do with it when you're done?
Yeah.
Because if you don't have a plan, nothing's going to happen.
Or they think about it too late after it's finished, and then they begin to think about it. And by the time they really get that together, it's old already.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think you just did a thing on this too about the no platinum records this year.
Yeah. Yeah. That was today.
You know, everybody's going, well, it's the first time ever. No, it's not the first time ever. It's, you know, there was a time when people didn't sell a million records. And, you know, I don't think the Beatles ever got a platinum album. Maybe they did, but not initially. You know, it's always been a singles market.
Well, that was a different story at the Beatles because they didn't give out platinum for a while in the UK.
Yeah.
They had different criteria for all that.
Yeah.
And regardless, though, you're right. There were times in the 50s you're right.
It's a singles market. In fact, I think the first four Rolling Stones albums were just compilations of singles. They weren't albums.
Yeah.
They were just singles that they put out. And the Beatles, too, to a certain degree. If you someone recently did a timeline on them and you see the windows that they have to record, was like, oh, my God, how did they do 13 albums in 7 years when they had 1 week here and 4 days there? And, you know, it was like, you know, hats off to George Martin for being, first of all, being able to just pull it off, just get the stuff recorded, much less how magnificently it was done, you know. But again, you know, that they didn't understand the business. And because they didn't understand the business, Paul McCartney is still fighting for ownership of his songs.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you want an example of learn the business, there it is.
Yeah.
You know, you really need to understand if you're going to make it anywhere, because there's no record company that's going to come in and do it for you. And even when there was, a record company might have been doing it to you rather than for you.
That's more the case.
You know. So learn the business.
This has been great. It's gone about twice as long as I normally do these things, but it was so fascinating. You're so good on this that I just figured we keep rolling. Francis, thank you so much for being with me today.
That was a lot of fun, Bobby. All righty.
To find out more about Francis, go to his website at francisbuckley.com. That's FRANCISBUCKLEY, francisbuckley.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyointercircle.com, questions@bobbyointercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the Producer Podcast at theproducer.club. Steve's responsible for putting the show together. I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyointercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.